Hi, it's Eric, Q105, Q105.com, the morning after Saturday mornings from 8 to 10. We are getting into, well, the buildup for walk season, like walk and charity season, run season, like, you know, call it spring and fall, the NAMI walk. National Alliance on Mental Illness is May 12th at UT. We've got some events coming up before that, one at Buffalo Wild Wings, and also a kickoff happy hour at the Dirty Bird. And there's very few people who get me really amped up and inspired. Sometimes it's hard for me to find some motivation. Not when I heard this gentleman speak at last year's NAMI kickoff luncheon. We're going to spend an hour here with Bill Berry, and I hope Bill is a local businessman. I don't even know where Bill works, what his corporation is. All I know is that he's got a great story. He's a great part of NAMI, and I think he's going to want to have you run through a wall like he did with me last year during the NAMI luncheon. This is an hour-long podcast. Enjoy it. Or good afternoon, whenever you're listening to this, the Morning After podcast on Q1055.com. The powers that be of Cumulus Media, and we are happy to be here now, came to me and said, Eric, you need even more diversity on the show. We've got black people, we've got gay people, we've got lesbians, we've got everything, but no Scotsman. We're going to change that now. Good morning, Mr. Should we do William Berry? Bill.
Bill is a lot easier, and yes, I do come from further north than sunny Toledo, Ohio.
And I loved what you said the other day when we were in the NAMI meeting. You're going to get your accent tuned up?
Yeah, I leave this Wednesday coming up, heading back to Bonnie, Scotland, just to have a tune-up, get my accent, get my food allocations that normally most people think are not very helpful,
right,
here in the United States, but I really don't care.
Okay. Before I introduce you and why I asked you to come in and sit in for a podcast, let me ask you this. Like, I know when I go home to Philadelphia, when I left Philadelphia, I would say water. Like, they say water instead of water.
We say wah.
When you go back to Scotland, are there any words that you've got to manipulate so the people understand you from having been here?
Not really, because I come from Glasgow, which is the west coast, which is a very granular accent. So it doesn't matter how many years you've been away. The only thing it changes is you try and slow down if you're in another country, to actually help them understand. But within 2 minutes of me landing at Glasgow Airport or Edinburgh Airport, I'm back into the swing of things.
Do you come back here after your trips with any words that you have to exit from your vocabulary?
Yes, some are considered appropriate in Scotland as part of the language.
Right.
Right? But here would be frowned upon, I would think. That's the polite way.
Like what?
Well, I think, you know, we normally, in Scottish language, four-letter words are part of the language. They're not viewed as being in anything other than just part of your communication process.
Right.
But in a lot of other places in the world, they're viewed as being, you know, not very appropriate, and you have a lack of vocabulary.
we can curse on here. It's okay, because it's just a podcast. So it's funny. It was funny to watch news organizations figure out, like 10 days or so ago, should we print shithole on our website from Trump's comments?
Yeah.
Like, because it was news, but it's like, that's interesting that you say that about Scotland, how four-letter words are accepted. We're opposed to here. Sometimes people feel as they're very profane or they lack vocabulary.
Yeah, and that isn't really the case. You know, you can go into a pub in Glasgow and we all probably sound the same. But normally, if you're really thinking and looking, the thing that will differentiate is not clothes, their appearance.
Mm-hmm.
But what will differentiate is normally the vocabulary that ultimately they'll use. So I can curse with the best of them, but if need be, I can switch to a different level using my vocabulary. Yeah. I will probably dress a lot worse than 90% of the people in the bar, right? Because that's important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas to me, as long as I'm comfortable.
That's an age thing, though.
Are you trying to say I'm getting a little bit old?
No, because I feel I do the same thing. It's all about comfort. But you're right, because people always say, how do you, like, not curse on the radio? I'm like, I don't know. It's just like a behavior.
Well,
like,
very much so.
I can flip this. I cursed once on the air, but I like to use curse language when I write up a blog, or I don't think that I have a small vocabulary. I think mine is at rather large, and I think there's an artful way to use vulgar words.
Most certainly.
But I know what you're saying, where there's a switch in my head where I can't use certain words when I'm on the air.
Yeah.
I wanted to have Bill in because about 11 months or so ago, for the NAMI kickoff luncheon at the Toledo Club, Bill was the speaker for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. This is the first time I met Bill, and Bill, being the chairman for the NAMI Walk, gave a speech, and I gave a quick talk as well about why I was part of the walk, and I got to know Bill and his story. But and we'll get to that in just a moment as to why Bill is connected to NAMI like I am with good mental health advocacy. But there are very few people, and we all have them in our life. We see, whether they're sports speeches or presidents or politicians or whoever, where you listen to them speak and you are ready to do whatever they say. They are great inspirers, great motivators. And I have very few of them in my life. I wish I could have listened and watched Abraham Lincoln speak, but I read his stuff and it's very motivating. I watched Bill speak and share his story about his daughter. And Bill, if you would have said, go run into a train, I would have taken that train on at 100 miles an hour, lost, but I would have felt good about it.
So thank you very much.
You are
for
a very
compliment.
Inspiring speaker. I would
thank
run
you.
Through a wall for you. So how did you get involved with NAMI? What's the impetus behind you having such having it such meaning in your life like myself?
Well, as you sort of intimated, I'm maybe a little bit older than
little
most
bit.
Parents. Yeah.
you might be older in age, but I think I'm older in feeling.
Yeah, the small.
There you go.
Yeah. Eric, what happened was I had been, for want of a better word, successful in a business career. I'd reached, a lot of personal goals, lived in a number of different countries, interacted with a great number of cultures, and eventually settled down in, with my beautiful wife Laura, who comes from Cuyahoga Falls in Akron. And let's be blunt, but we struggled to have a kid, and but we definitely knew we wanted one. So we eventually, at the grand old age of 43, became parents of a beautiful 5-day old girl, and we named her Mackenzie Fiona Berry. Now, I think you can just get the drift of the Scottishness there.
A little bit.
At that time as well, we actually had the benefit of Laura's mother, Eileen, living with us. So she helped, a great deal. And the only problem was I was away 70% of the time. So they built their own, what I would say, micro community.
Mm-hmm.
And I would come back at the weekend. And, it was difficult for me to integrate, I would have my own way of doing things. And that wasn't fair to either my wife or my daughter or my mother-in-law. But I could be pig-headed. Anyhow, I had been president and chairman at NSK, one of the largest steering systems groups in the Americas, never home. And Mackenzie was starting to go through school, and grandma died when she was about 12, and that really hurt her because she was really close. Then we started seeing a little bit of difficulty where she had stomach ache, headache, not wanting to go to school, things like that. And I started to cut back my travel because I felt it was unfair. And this is important. What I see at NAMI quite often, Eric, is that at the support meetings, nearly 80% of the people there are women.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get that fatherly input. Yeah. So I decided, you know, luckily I could step down for a while. And at that time I was driving home and she had gone to Cardinal Stritch, which she still is at. Fantastic, great school, great people, you know, a loving environment. But one day I got a call and the headmaster said, "Bill, you need to get here." And I says, "Why?" And he told me, "Your daughter has basically slashed her arm in front of some other pupils." And that's when I really started to be concerned.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I thought, well, surely this is a one-off. But I didn't realise that, you know, Mackenzie had been telling us that she was feeling down and depressed. But, you know, us parents say, well, hey, get over it.
Right.
And to be honest, now that I think back on it, that wasn't the right response. But I didn't know better.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I should have known better because both my parents, my grandma, and my sister suffered manic depression, had been hospitalised. But it, because I was this driven type of personality, I always used to say, hey, take a rest and it'll be okay in the morning.
Right.
That didn't happen. She went from being a 4.0 to acting out more and more and more.
How old was she around this time?
She was probably around about 13, Eric,
okay,
at the time. And, you know, we then were told she was put into the Kohlbacher Centre, which was here. But the problem is, because of the lack of resources, she was back out in 3 days.
Right.
Yeah. Nothing really had changed. Yeah. And her behaviour, obviously, in acting out, and her depression got worse. And she struggled. And I have to admit, my response to it was, I can't fix this. Why can't I fix it? Because I've always been a fixer.
Right.
And to me, I just couldn't understand it. How a smart dude like me, problem solving whiz, couldn't fix this issue. Well, hey, this isn't business. This isn't playing soccer or rugby or anything like that. This is your daughter. And you got to bear in mind, I didn't really have a great relationship with Mackenzie because I was away a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So when she wouldn't get up in the morning, I reacted badly.
Right.
The cutting continued. The behavioural issues, interacting with, let's just say, people that I would not wish her to interact. And she eventually got to a point where she would stay out late. Sometimes she tried to run away. And my wife, Laura, and I were just beside ourselves.
Let me ask you, what was your wife's reaction to a lot of this?
Well, she had been seeing, you know, a type of behavioural thing over the years, but never really thought, you know, Grandma had said, you know, just be careful and watch. But, you know, getting into teenage years, you know, you've probably heard it many times. Well, it's just that teenage phase. But it wasn't enough. It was much worse.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know where to go, to be perfectly honest with you. And from my own personal point of view, and this was a sad thing, I was thinking more about myself, right? What are people going to think, right?
Right.
And this goes to this stigma situation. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, I'm not one for crying, but I actually found myself actually in tears one day.
Was it Was it more guilt that you hadn't been around and maybe that's what led to this? Or was it more stigma that people were going to think I'm a terrible parent?
I think a bit of both.
Right. It's right? Usually the answer.
Yeah, a bit of both.
A bit of both.
But I think if you ask Mackenzie now, you know, when, and she's, we'll get to that as she's progressed through everything. She basically said, Dad, you were only in thinking about what did the CEO of this company or people here think of you?
Right.
You weren't thinking of my happiness or, you know.
What were you thinking, though?
I was thinking, God, where did this come from?
Right. Did it make you think about your relatives that you spoke of?
Yes. And I talked to my sister. And my sister, it's no secret, she had been on medication from maybe early 20s to mid 30s. And it took that long for her to actually find, in her words, a proper counselor that actually got it.
I concur.
Actually got it.
That was my path as well. Because usually, to go back just a little bit, it's hard. I don't talk to teenagers because I don't have the experience with it where you don't know if it's a teenager being a teenager and they got to grow out of it or they're going to grow into some kind of mental health issue. And my stuff manifested itself as with most people, young adulthood. So you spend your 20s finding the medication, battling it, and maybe bad things happen, or finding the right counselor as your sister did.
Yeah.
But it made you, Mackenzie's problem made you talk to your sister.
Yeah, and she says, well, have you, and I says, I don't know who to go to, right? And then I was talking to someone one day, and they said, well, have you ever gone to NAMI? I went, that's a strange name. What
yes, it is.
Is NAMI? And he goes, that's the National Alliance of Mental Illness, and it's based in Central, past CCOR. I thought, oh. So I went there one day, and they kindly sat down with me and asked me, well, what's the matter? I said, I don't know how to explain this. You know, I told them about the cutting. I told them about being hospitalized. I told them about the behavior issue. And they listened, right? So they said to me, why don't you come to this support meeting? So I went to this support meeting, and there was all sorts of people there. Maybe not all sorts like me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that. What I mean was that demographically, they weren't like me.
Right. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah. So I then asked, well, where can I get help? So they gave me this list of counselors and stuff like that. Well, I really didn't understand. Because I'd never been to a counsellor myself. You know, I might have talked to myself, but I'd never been to a counsellor. And then I started research, and then I realised that, you know, in most parts of the world, there's very few universities, so you have to really, it's all academics, right? But I've realised in America, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, you know, you can get a degree off the back of a Rice Krispies box, right? So you've got all these people who are, I've got a master's degree in social studies and all that sort of stuff. And we then started sending, taking Mackenzie to one or two. And she would say, Dad, all they want to talk about is what movie did we watch this week? And, you know, and how was your day? And what was going on? And she says it's of no use to me at all.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's when, obviously, she then got a wee bit more involved. She switched from the Catholic school to a public school. And don't get me wrong, those people at the public school were really supportive. But the environment was just not conducive.
Chaotic?
Absolutely.
Almost, I guess, like fuel to the fire?
Yes.
Of what was going on inside of her?
Yes. Yeah, that is an excellent way of... And every day we would be getting phone calls. Can you come and pick her up? Can you do this? And you know,
it's almost like as an adult, for someone like me, the stress would magnify my symptoms. That chaotic environment that she was put into magnified hers.
Yes. Yeah.
Had she had a diagnosis at this point?
No. They basically had said to her, said to us, well, you know, the initial thing, and I can understand it, they say, we don't want to label people. That was the first thing. And I says, well, how do you help them? How do you support them if you do not diagnose? So we then went to the Sophia Centre at Lourdes University, and they did an amazing detailed analysis of not only Mackenzie, but her environment and stuff like that. And they come back and said that there was depression, so anxiety, ADD, not ADHD, ADD. You know, she wasn't manic flying around the room like a 250cc motorbike, you know.
Right.
She was ADD. And they said she was needy, you know, she wanted to be loved. And then they started saying, but there's something interesting going on here. You need to go in more depth, because she would keep on asking us, do we love her? Yeah. And we said, of course we love her. And what I didn't realise was, you know, I never really told her I loved her too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a typical old-fashioned Scotsman, you know? You know, I look after you. What more do you want?
Right, you know? Right.
And I never ever thought about the emotional side. And then one day I thought to myself, you know, when I was away years and years ago, they sent me to Colorado Springs, and there was 4 four-star generals. There was, you know, all the echelons. And for a week and a half, they put us through TV, testing, all sorts of stuff. And at the end of it, they said, most people who are in what you would call jobs where there's no real, you need to have this, you know, for example, you need to have this product on this manufacturing line or else it's going to cost you $1 million. Most of the people weren't in that stress-filled environment. And there was two of us. And the thing that came out was my emotional IQ was very low.
Right.
So I expected everybody to perform at my level.
Right.
Right? And I was putting that on Mackenzie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew she was bright, but she had other interests. You know, she was brilliant at English language. She was brilliant at languages, brilliant at art. You know, even very good at, you know, things like biology and stuff like that. You know, she hated other science and math, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if she's pushed, she can do it.
Right.
Right? But I think there was a little bit of rebellion there in the sense of, you know, I'm not doing it because you keep on pushing me. So I would ask her, have you done your homework? She'd say, yes, but I wouldn't believe her. I didn't realise that that lack of trust from me to my daughter was actually compounding this.
Yeah, I can understand that.
Part of them initially said, well, she's got what is called borderline.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, well, it's not like bipolar where if you hit the right tablet, yeah, and keep on it, you know, you'll have your bad days, but on the whole, it should be okay. Most of this was how you react, you know, behaviourally. Obviously,
right.
Moods and everything else. So we then realised from talking to other people and advice from NAMI, they said, have you ever been a dialectic therapist? And again, I'm ashamed to say, I thought, what is a dialect?
I don't know what that is.
What is a dialect? And here, the explanation I was given was that a dialectic therapist is really skilled and uses tools to actually help people. So they will very rarely just talk about sunny days and movies and that. They'll actually take you through and say, right, step one, how are you feeling? And, you know, have you ever used mindfulness in the moment? And each week they would take them through. Now, Mackenzie rebelled against that.
How come?
Because she again said, I don't need it. There's nothing the matter with me.
Okay, so she was defiant towards what was going on with her.
Yes.
That's a big problem.
Yeah, yeah. And unfortunately, I reacted, well, bloody hell, you need to. And
right.
That compounded the issue.
Sure.
It got to a point into her sophomore year at public high school that it just, she wouldn't go to school, you know, anxiety, all sorts of things, not well. And ultimately, I talked to my parish priest, and he said, I don't really know a great deal about it. He says, but have you ever thought in any relationship that maybe, you know, you could help? So I thought, it's not me.
Right.
Yeah? And he says, no. He says, are you compassionate? Are you positive? How do you react to her friendships and people that she hangs around with? Has she ever been a bad kid? So I went home and I started thinking. And I thought to myself, she hasn't really been a bad kid. She is bright when she wants to be. But I then thought back, I managed to get my degree out of a university, again, in Scotland. It was all academics.
Mm-hmm.
I managed to get my first degree in three. I was out by the time I was 20. And my dad said to me, just think what you could have done if you had actually focused and worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, what the heck? You know, most people take another 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I did this. That's when I realised that I needed to part of the solution.
You realized, like you mentioned earlier,
yep.
Emotional IQ, where you could get very smart, whether by going to a school or reading a box of Rice Krispies.
Right.
One thing that you're not taught, other than from really your parents and the people that surround you, mm-hmm. is how to say and feel, I love you.
That's right.
And that's probably where, after speaking with your priest,
yep.
there was some reflection.
Yep.
And for all this infinite intelligence and knowledge, it's
yep.
like, maybe you thought at the time, because my dad and I are like that. Like, I understand the love is there.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't need to say it. My mom was more of I love you the part.
Right.
I love you.
Yeah.
But I lack intimacy in my life because they did, but I'm cognizant of it. And it keeps me from being intimate. But I wonder if after the priest said that to you, you wondered, when's the last time I told Mackenzie I love her?
I did ask that question, and then I realized not only hadn't I told Mackenzie I loved her, but I actually hadn't even said it to my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what an idiot. I then said, I need to educate myself, not from an academic point of view, but I need to become more open, more compassionate. And I then went to NAMI's Family Basics course, which is a fantastic course. And that helped me, and it was telling me using techniques and stuff like that. And I started to go on a Monday evening. There's a family support meeting. And slowly but surely, working with the right dialectic therapist and a good psychiatrist, the meds were stabilized and she actually started trusting them. And I then started realizing that I had to deal with that. And I also realized that I couldn't cope with it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And thankfully, I've got a fantastic wife, Laura. And we basically, when she sees that I'm starting to stress out, she steps in and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And what I noticed on that support meetings, a lot of these people didn't have that.
Right.
What also happened was that as I became more, I really don't give a damn about the stigma. This is my beautiful daughter.
Right.
Right? Heck. People actually started coming and talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, why are we talking? She says, well, we know that you've been successful, confident, relaxed and everything. And you talk about it and you're not embarrassed. You're not stigmatized. You're not. So I, all of a sudden I started to the point that you made, Eric, these professional couples where, as my daughter sometimes calls, they had all American girls that go to some of the old girls' schools round about here. As soon as they left home, chaos.
Right. The system was gone from them.
That's right. So they left Sylvania, Toledo, and within 1 or 2 years, they were in and out of hospital and all sorts of. And I said, well, did you never notice? Well, we used to fill their days and nights with basketball, STEM classes, swimming, right?
The structure was gone. It was time for you to be on your own, to right? take what you had learned from your parents and put it into play. I'm lucky. I always speak well of my parents. And I think, again, this is one of the things that I have a hard time to process because I don't have kids. I just was one,
right?
Where all the things your parents taught you, you're going to go out and you're going to screw things up and you're going to do some bad things,
right?
And you're either going to continue down that path because the structure you were given was not enough,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to go, okay, I screwed up, it's time to take what I learned, not disappoint my family, friends, and get back in line.
Yes.
And there's that fork in the road.
Yeah.
And when that structure is gone for certain teenagers, it's like you said, it's the word we keep coming back to. It's chaotic.
Yeah. And not just chaotic. You know, what I didn't realize was that because that chaos becomes more, sometimes it doesn't come until their late 20s and early 30s. And it's the other thing I realized, that it's got nothing to do with how smart they are, you know, academically. You know, most people view those who are suffering mental illness, well, there's something really the matter with them. Some of the brightest people I've met have suffered deep depression, anxiety, bipolar, you know, schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
right? It's got nothing to do with academic IQs. It's got all to do with the chemistry and everything else. And it took us, Eric, I think I've actually got in my phone nearly 40 changes of medication over a 2-year period. And I used to become very pushy to the psychiatrist and say, if I made that many mistakes,
right,
I would have been fired long ago. Yeah. And I became more and more moving toward advocacy,
mm-hmm.
because I had the vocabulary, I had the economic status to push. But then I looked on a Monday night and 95% of them there, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
They have no one to advocate for them, right? And I then started to look at that and start not reacting to, you know, if my daughter tells me she's not feeling well in the morning, Nowadays, 99% of the time, Mackenzie's not feeling well. Genuinely. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was, you know, I think she thought, well, it doesn't matter what I say to my dad. He doesn't believe me anyhow.
Right.
Yeah? And I then felt, well, how do we help people? And how do we, from a selfish point of view, how do I help myself? And then Mackenzie, about 9 months ago or maybe more, decided she didn't like feeling this way all the time.
Yeah, it sucks.
Right? And she then said, Dad, I need structure. Round about May or June, she said, Dad, can I go back to Cardinal Stritch? So Mum and I are looking at her, you know, and saying, well, wait a minute, you know, it costs money.
Right.
We're not going to be given any discounts or anything like that, our sponsorship. Plus, on a good day, it takes you 30 minutes to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But she says, Dad, I will show you. At that time as well, she started interacting with other people. And that helped. They were more positive, less judgmental. So that then got me thinking, well, maybe part of my problem is that I'm judgmental. Yeah?
We all are to a degree.
And then one day, because she's a great person, because of the use of the English language, she's great at debating, right? So she then approached me, knowing my Catholic faith and how I felt about things. She then said to me, two or three of my friends are gay. And I said, well, and it was a, I remember it. I said, well, I need to be more compassionate. I need to show more mercy. And I need to think for myself on this. I know that might sound strange, you know, rather than getting, you know, what it says there, I actually think for myself. And I said, would these people, you know, because in a lot of spheres, they basically say, well, the reason you're gay is just a phase you're going through, right? And, you know, there's nothing in it. And I thought to myself one night, these people wouldn't put themselves through this.
Mm-hmm.
To be abused and ridiculed and treated like second-class citizens and all that. So I then opened up a wee bit and says, okay, if you want to spend the night with a couple of your gay friends. She says, Dad, I'm not gay, but they're great people. They're right. Lovely people, everything, you know. And that was a step in me becoming a little bit more considerate.
Mm-hmm.
And Mackenzie reciprocated by not reacting to every single thing. If you, with borderline, if you look at someone, you might be smiling at them, Eric. They actually transmit it as, you're angry.
Mm-hmm.
She has used the tools that her great therapist gave her, and she now doesn't react, overreact. She has her days, you know.
Sure, we all do.
You know, but nowhere near. Last semester, she was only late, I think, for school about 3 or 4 times. And for the first time in her whole high school career, she actually passed every exam. And she's currently on a 3.3, 3.4 GPA. And I'm trying to pick my battles. I really am. Because guess what? If she would just hand in some of that goddamn homework on time, she would... She would be way up there.
Right.
But when she has her bad days, they're much, much less in terms of intensity.
Sure.
And she's been doing a lot of fantastic poetry, writing it. She says, Dad, I write it in the middle of the night. We just got word yesterday, the, you know, the National Scholastics thing for arts and writing. She got a high mention, and they're asking her if she could go to an award ceremony, yeah, for writing a poetry. And the poetry is very raw. It talks about how it felt when she cut herself and how she looks at herself now, yeah? That she can see, a vague still signs, yeah, but they're not.
They're emotional and physical scars.
Yes, yes.
You said, to go back for a moment, about the intensity of the bad days. That's something that I like to share for my story as well. Now that, you know, I've removed a lot of stress and my medication is where it needs to be. Perfected techniques that I've learned and read about and worked on with my therapist. It is amazing because it has shortened the length of these valleys of depression. Nobody's never going to have bad. Nobody, even if you're totally mentally healthy, is not going to have, you're going to have bad days. But before, when I would have a bad day, it would domino into a bad 2 weeks or a bad month. And now they're like bad thoughts that might linger for half an afternoon and then they go away. So I'm happy to see that. And the point of all of this is there is help and hope, and you've explored it and tapped into it with the frustrating but eventually successful medication changes and working with a therapist. And she's taken the intensity down of those bad days where before, I'll tell you the story, and you can probably relate it to her. There are days where I would refuse to get out of bed because I would just want to go to sleep, and that was it. Now, I still want to lay in bed, but because I'm tired, not because I don't have an emotional ability to wrestle with the day. Like, that's gone.
Right. No. That's I seen it, been there, done that, saw it, and you're entirely right, you know. Normally now when she struggles, it's like a Saturday morning, and she'll stay in bed, you know, but that's normal.
That's
for
a teenager.
Yeah, so my wife and I now actually are able to tell the difference and actually say, whoa, you know, this is teenage life.
Right.
And, I think the main thing, the story is that there was days where I felt like giving up. I have to be honest, right? But between me and my wife, we never gave up on her. Ever.
Mm-hmm.
We are so proud of how she has helped herself that we just want her to know that she can do whatever she wants in life. She can achieve it. And it's not about what I want. It's about her happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it took me all this journey to realize that I've probably got the most beautiful, smart daughters Emily could imagine. But it's no good if she is getting a 4.0 GPA and she's a basket case.
Mm-hmm.
And she's unhappy and she's depressed, anxious, everything. I just want her to utilize her God-given gifts. And if that means she does what her old dad did and ended up with a less than a 4.0, but she's happy and enjoys life and she's doing what she would like to do, that's what it's all about.
You can use this if you want. I came up with it, but I probably stole the sentiment from someone else. And I share this with people all the time who are unhappy at work. Maybe their job pays really well, but I like to say that happiness is a currency.
Yeah.
Happiness is a currency. You might be making $100,000, but you're miserable and you can't enjoy life, like Mackenzie and myself at some point. Maybe you could make $60,000, work just as much, but you could enjoy it. And I assure you, that money you're making will go farther than the bigger check you are getting because you can enjoy life more. Happiness is a currency. It's something
that's
share with so many people.
That is excellent. And, you know, we still understand that we've got a road to go, and it'll always be a road. But the fact that Mackenzie herself understands how to deal with her feelings at times is like a huge step forward.
She has the weapons to combat what's going on.
That's right.
And she knows it.
And we used to, at one point early on, we would see her therapist once a week. We are now once every 2 months. Her psychiatrist used to be once every 2 weeks. We're now up to once every 3 or 4 months, right?
Yeah.
That's all down to her. It's not MDLs, it's down to her. But it's also, from our point of view, looking at how mental health is dealt with. I didn't realise how in the closet this was.
Yeah.
I just, it took me a while. Sorry for being a bit slow, but it took me a while to realise, man, this took ages for the penny to drop. And now, when I talk to people, people actually talk to me and say, my sister-in-law has been suffering for 30 years and, my brother, and they're actually opening that. I say, well, have you got help? Have you seeked help? Well, it's embarrassing to talk about it. No, it isn't.
Mm-hmm. Not for us.
Not for us.
I have a final question about Mackenzie. How does she talk about it as openly as we do?
Mackenzie now is at a point, and she said to me just the other morning earlier, Dad, I think it was more a matter of depression, anxiety, the fact that I felt you didn't trust me, so I acted out.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I do have ADHD, and that sometimes puts me, out of in left field at times. She says, occasionally, how I react. But she says, I don't feel, and these are her words, I don't feel that I've got borderline. I do feel that I've went through the last 2 or 3 years, and she says, I don't regret it. It's actually making me who I am,
mm-hmm,
and who I will ultimately be. But no, Mackenzie doesn't talk that way. And part of it, believe it or not, is that when she goes to her dialectic therapist now, I join her. So she'll go in for maybe the first 40 minutes, and then the last 15 minutes we'll go in, and we'll talk, and if there's anything that I've been seeing and I've talked about, and we'll talk about it. And that has helped before. In the past, that would never happen. Yeah. And she now feels great that she's got her family, she's got her friends, she's got Derek, her therapist, she's got Dr. Rana, her psychiatrist, she's got this. And plus, the big thing is the school teachers at Cardinal Spritch are just an amazing group of people who show love. It's not just turning up in the classroom. They actually take an interest in the well-being of their pupils. And, I think going forward, my advocacy is that if I can use my voice, resources, abilities to make available to the population of Greater Toledo the resources to help them, educate them, not just one-on-one, Eric, but I'm talking going to the school systems, teaching the teachers,
mm-hmm,
right? Doing the teaching of sheriff's deputies and police officers, yeah? So that they don't come in guns blazing, because that happens, they escalate everything. It's all education.
A quick aside, I was in a meeting yesterday for a talk I'm doing coming up, and there were some former teachers in there that said they would take kids like the ones we're discussing and they would be labeled as like special ed kids.
Right.
I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. Like, right. That's not them. Like, there's just some. And to go back to what McKenzie thought about like not having a diagnosis, as much as me getting one for like bipolar 2 was enlightening, I do agree wholeheartedly with her that, and I'm always candid about this as well, like this is hard for people to grasp where at the moment we can't scan for this stuff with accuracy. Like if something's wrong with my knee,
right,
I can go through an MRI and go, right, you have a torn ACL. Mm-hmm. There's ligaments. Here it's a lot more shadowy. Mm-hmm. So I think to McKenzie's point where the diagnosis doesn't often matter. Sometimes a baseline is good to start somewhere to get medication or help. But the bottom line is talk about the feelings. Right. And if the feelings are awry or extreme, whether it's elation mania or the other side, depression, who cares? Who cares what the fuck it's called?
Right.
Talk about it and let's fix it. And thankfully, even though you went through an agonizing period of time, I think it was a lot shorter than many people who.
I have no doubt about it, and that's why I'm so committed, Eric, to helping. Because you know, my parents both died within 6 months of each other with cancer. The family, so I'm well aware of the physical impacts it have, and all of these illnesses have huge focus and resources. Mm-hmm. Last year alone, just in North America, the business world lost nearly $260 billion due to mental health issues such as anxiety, depression, maybe not necessarily with the individuals working there, but they call it, you know, back home, the lights are on but nobody's in, because you're at work and you're not thinking about that. You're thinking about your husband or your daughter. And nobody bothers from an educational point of view to actually say to these businesses, you should put a bit of money in. You know, employee assistance programs? Mm-hmm. There's some getting growing.
I talk about them a lot, yeah.
Right? So that needs to happen. And we also need individuals not to feel ostracized, mm-hmm, right? It's like, you know, people say, you know, I've broke my arm, a badge of honor. Yeah.
I have bipolar, badge of honor.
Right.
One of the things that I found within it when I got the diagnosis, I was like, oh, you know what? That's kind of cool. Didn't they say that about like Einstein? Mm. Like I saw it as my source of creativity.
Right.
So you're right.
And I would just ask not only the community, come out on Saturday the 12th of May, mm-hmm, you know, at UT Medical Center down there behind the Rockets football.
Yep.
And help us sign up a team, sign up individuals. Come sign up to our Facebook, sign up to our Twitter account, our Instagram account. Get informed. Yeah. Participate. Don't stand in the sidelines. And there's more people here to support you, talk to you. We've got a great Family Navigator program that is there to guide you if you don't know. And contact NAMI of Greater Toledo and realize that, you know, it's a new day now. We are here as an organization to educate and make mental health not a stigma, mm-hmm, but something that is there, needs to be supported, research needs to be worked on. And the only way we can do that is by support from not only corporations, but also individuals and families. And I can't be more proud of how my family has stood up and supported not only us as an individual family, but others. And we hope that this progress, and this is the other thing, those who are watching it, the difference in what happens, maybe your friends and your relatives say, well, I was expecting them to improve from point A to point Z. Mm-hmm. Hey, now I'm a little bit smarter, not much. I actually am quite happy when I see Mackenzie go from F to G and then G to H, because it's a progression in the right direction. So patience, and that was nothing in my DNA. Patience was not something I was great at. But we're trying. But the main thing is, mental health is here. And unfortunately, whether we agree to it or not, social media, bullying, all that stuff is here to stay.
Mm-hmm. So we have to learn to cope better.
Coping mechanisms are all about. And, you know, I've took me a long time, but I realized that, you know, I didn't cause it. I can't fix it. I can help.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the word that I used to dislike, but I can understand it now, was, well, you just have to cope with it. In Europe, using the word cope means you're not dealing with it.
What's another word? Like manage?
Manage, yeah.
They're all the same word.
They're all the same word, yeah. But, you know, as I said, exceptionally proud of how Mackenzie is moving forward. And that doesn't mean to say, Eric, you know, like the other morning there, we were, you know, arguing away, going, you know, we use the time to talk, right? And we differ on different things.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. But the great thing is, in the past, it would have triggered a meltdown.
Oh, yeah.
Not now.
Oh, yeah. I get it. I know what that's
like. Those meltdowns used to be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for Mackenzie, but for her, for her property.
Right.
Everything. And, you know, it's something that needs to be considered. So, as I said, please, to your listeners, you know, thank you to Eric for being so open and being a champion. And, you know, keep listening, keep focusing, and looking for that next positive day, because that is what's going to happen. We are going to keep building the resources to help people, but we need you to participate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's most organizations, there might be a 200 in the organization, but only 20 of them participate. We need to change that philosophy. If we've got 1,000, 2,000 participating, we want everybody to be in. We want them to be active. And don't worry, you can communicate now with people in a very professional way, and don't be upset at what they think. Because realistically, if they're taking that backward approach on what you're suffering a mental illness or your kid is, then they're not the positive people that you need to be around.
I agree. I mentioned that when I get to talk to people. I give people a for instance, one of two things is going to happen. If I were to, let's say you wanted to go talk to somebody, a friend. One of two things is going to happen if you tell them that, like, hey, I've had some really dark thoughts, mm-hmm. or my behavior's been really, one of two things will happen. One, that friend will say, we got to get you some help. I've heard Eric and Bill, Nami, that weird, let's go talk about this. Or they're going to say, you're out of your mind, you're crazy, let's go have a drink and we'll fix this. I do, look, we throw the word crazy and lunatic around because it's part of, you know, the lexicon. But when I talk about this stuff, I don't use those words because those are the words that stigmatize things. So one of those two things is going to happen. And to your point, if someone says you're crazy, you're, you know, don't mention that, that's not the person that's going to help you.
Nope.
Maybe that's the person that's causing some of what's going on. Go with the person who said, hey, this is not a big deal. There's some classes, come in, talk, you know, maybe your medication with few, be around those people.
And I'll be honest, at times one could consider that I could have been one of those people who were negative and toxic in nature. You know, I'm naturally a positive person, but when it came to this, something, because it was so close to me, I didn't react the way I should have done.
Sure.
But thankfully, I have. I've improved. I need to keep improving every day. But the main thing is to be upfront, supportive, not only of my own family, but anybody else that requires. And as I said, NAMI's a great organisation. You're a great ambassador for us. And we hope that we see a lot of you over the next couple of months join us to make it, you know, against stigma as the main motto.
Look at that. I told you. You're going to want to run through a wall for this guy. You can even end the podcast. Well, well done. You're free to go to Scotland now.
Thank you.
Bill, that was a good time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Great to have spoken to you today. Thank you.